The next argument is in case number 21-2225, Pride Technologies versus Klublol.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Neil Klausner, Davis & Gilbert, LLP, on behalf of Appellant Pride Technologies, Inc., doing business as Pride One. We are here appealing the District Court's grant of summary judgment against my client on its claim of tortious interference with business relations against the appellee, Daniel Klublol. We believe the record demonstrates significant issues of fact, which would require a trial of this cause of action, issues pertaining to Mr. Klublol's motive, intent, motivations, and the extent to which he caused Thomson Reuters, his employer, to terminate its relationship with Pride. On this appeal, this court has the right for de novo review of our motion for summary judgment. Pride is a human capitals firm. Among its services are payroll services, and that is onboarding temporary staff, employing them, paying them, administering their benefits, and other human resource capabilities. It had this job for the temporary staffing at Thomson Reuters starting in 2013, and consistently received excellent feedback from Thomson Reuters. No criticism. There had been discussions about expanding that relationship globally and to extend it, the types of services that Pride would provide.
So, but Thomson had begun this direct sourcing program. They hired a consultant to advise them, and then they were getting rid of Pontoon, I guess, the company. And so I think this goes to causation. It seemed like this relationship was going to be ending anyways, and I'm wondering what you have to say to that.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. No, the direct source capabilities of this entity, TalentNet, was irrelevant to the services that Pride was providing to Thomson Reuters. It affected how the temporary staff was identified, whether it was through recruiters, staffing agencies, or directly through some artificial intelligence technology that TalentNet said it was developing. That would have no bearing on Pride continuing to provide payroll services to the staff that TalentNet or Pontoon hired.
Not somebody who's just outside the company interfering in the relationship, right? He's part of Thomson. And wasn't it his job to come up with a direct sourcing model and to determine how Thomson was going to do contingent labor? And wouldn't it be, therefore, within the scope of his employment to decide that I want to move to a different vendor or arrange things in a different way? Maybe it was a bad decision, but the question is, isn't it in the scope of his employment?
What was in the scope of his employment, sure, was deciding how to select the staff for Thomson Reuters. He was the head of the direct sourcing group within Thomson Reuters.
Right, so if you decide that actually we're going to use a different vendor, even though the other one, there are no issues with it, but I think this other vendor has a more effective model, or I've devised a more effective model involving different vendors, that would be within the scope of his employment. You have to show some reason to think that he's acting ultra vires, don't you?
Yes, but, so that's not what happened here. What happened here was, as set forth in our papers, there was a malicious motive by Mr. Klublol to get rid of Pride as a vendor for Thomson Reuters. Mr. Klublol thought his job was in jeopardy because his two prior supervisors had been fired, and he thought he was next in line, and devised a scheme and came to Pride.
And wanted a job from them.
Wanted a job from Pride and said, you need to start referring business to TalentNet. you need to start remitting some of the payments from Thomson Reuters to TalentNet, and otherwise, he threatened to terminate the relationship with Pride.
Pride. How does that make sense that he wanted a job from Pride, and so therefore he threatened Pride to support TalentNet?
His plan was to leave Thomson Reuters, or he was going to be let go by Thomson Reuters, as he ultimately was, and to join Pride with TalentNet already on board. We believe the evidence suggests he was a stakeholder in TalentNet. He was promoting TalentNet to many other parties without Thomson Reuters' knowledge, and was pressuring us to do the same.
Thomson Reuters looked into this and determined that this was a business decision, right? Thomson Reuters is not upset that he did something that is in the interests of his own personal interest as opposed to the company's, right?
There are factual issues about that. What happened was Mr. Kublal presented to Thomson Reuters that he had conducted a request for proposal, an RFP, to determine who the vendor should be, but he misled his employer about what had happened. This was a sham RFP. He met privately with TalentNet before the RFP was even rolled out.
Did explain that to Thomson, and Thomson did an investigation and still is not unhappy with the result, right?
Again, factual issues, because Mr. Kublal presented misinformation to his employer in connection with that investigation, and they did not interview anybody from TalentNet. They didn't interview anybody from Pontoon. They just accepted Mr. Kublal's words, which were not accurate.
What's the misinformation? The idea that Pride, you know, was not a global company, or didn't?
Pride was not a global company. Pride did not embrace this direct source technology. Those were false. Those are demonstrably false. And
are they demonstrably false? I mean, isn't that an opinion that somebody in the human resources industry might have? Like, isn't it? I mean, I understand that you like the business of your client, but might somebody not have different opinions about different sourcing models?
No, whether Pride is capable of global servicing is a demonstrably provable fact. Its parent is Pride Global. We have offices all over the world. Mr. Kublal knew that. We also presented a response to that RFP which emphasized that we did embrace the direct source technology and would collaborate with TalentNet in rolling that out. So his suggestion to his supervisors that we refused to embrace that technology was demonstrably false. It was right there in the RFP.
So Mr. Kublal himself didn't have the authority to terminate Pride, is that right?
Well, he said he did have the authority, and he wrote to Pontoon.
So are you disputing that? Are you saying that he did have the authority in fact?
We say he did have the authority, and that is a hotly disputed fact as well. Mr. Kublal says he did not, but at his deposition, we repeatedly asked him, if not you, who at Thomson Reuters decided to fire Pride? He refused to answer that question. Who at Thomson Reuters was critical of Pride other than you?
Like
he refused to answer.
People in the chain of command above him who had to sign off on the terminations of vendor contracts.
Well, he said he had a supervisor in Europe who was not involved in this process, to whom he was feeding this misinformation, who would have to sign off. But we
so
see what
you're saying different things now. I think your first answer was he did in fact have the authority. It's disputed, but you think he did. And now it seems like you're saying, well, no, he misled his supervisors who did have the authority. And, you kind of have to pick a theory, don't you?
Yes, he told us he had the authority. We have located in discovery his communication to his supervisor in Europe, saying that he had decided to move this business after the RFP, just a week after, to TalentNet. And so we think the evidence shows, or at least there is an issue of fact, that it was his decision. He did report it to his supervisor, and what he told the supervisor is he based his decision on the fact that we didn't have global capabilities, we didn't embrace this change, and we did. We did have global capabilities, we did embrace the change, and he didn't tell his supervisors about all of the work he had been doing surreptitiously for TalentNet and his desire to get TalentNet on board. He didn't tell his supervisors that TalentNet had in fact helped him devise the RFP. He met privately with TalentNet and the other vendor, Randstad, in advance of the RFP to ensure that they would be the winners.
So isn't that your real argument? So it's got to be the case that whenever somebody decides to make a decision to drop one vendor and adopt another, they're going to say something critical about the one vendor. I don't know if that shows that he's acting outside the scope of his employment. But if he's in cahoots with TalentNet to give them some special benefit that's not deserved for his own private interests, that might establish being outside the scope. But I guess the problem is Thompson seems happy with TalentNet, right? Like, what is the harm to Thompson from adopting TalentNet as opposed to Pride?
Well, Thompson,
like, even if Kublal got some private benefit by cozying up to TalentNet, if in fact it was still a legitimate business decision that served the interests of Thompson, wouldn't that still make it okay? Don't you have to show that there has to be a harm to the company?
Well, Thomson Reuters decided to end its relationship with Pride as a result of Mr. Kublal's determination based upon inaccurate information. And so Thomson Reuters was the victim of the misinformation, of the lack of knowledge about Kublal's collaboration with TalentNet, of the misrepresentations about Pride's capabilities. Thomson Reuters had been in fact, others at Thomson Reuters, when they learned about this, were very upset and confused about why Mr. Kublal did this. And there are documents in the record suggesting that others, not just Pride, thought that he had a vested interest in TalentNet, and he was doing this for personal gain, not for the benefit of Thomson Reuters. And so we believe that there are at least issues of fact which should have precluded summary judgment. Let a fact finder sort through this conflicting evidence.
Is there evidence that shows that actually it wasn't in Thompson's interest to make that decision? Besides people being surprised by it, like, is there a... So if we're trying to establish whether he's acting in his own private interest to the detriment of the company, as opposed to his own private interest, which is consistent with the interest of the company, what establishes that? What shows that?
Well, his personal interest was to ensure that TalentNet got the job, and that he punished Pride for refusing to be complicit with him, and the company suffered because they didn't have a payroll vendor who had the capabilities. I mean, we didn't have global capability. TalentNet was a startup, and they had to get Randstad, this other company, to finance the payrolling until TalentNet was built up. So he misled his employer as to the capabilities of TalentNet, which replaced Pride.
Okay, I understand that. Can I just ask, you mentioned him being dismissed from Thompson. Does the record show that he was terminated in relation to this decision?
No, it doesn't show that, but the record does show that shortly after he was terminated, TalentNet signed a contract with him and his company to continue sending him business, and to our knowledge, to this very day, he is collaborating and partnering with TalentNet, and we think he had that vested interest all along, which he did not disclose to his employer.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You've reserved a couple minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Grossman.
Good morning. Daniel Grossman of Harris, St. Laurent, and Wexler for Daniel Kublal. May it please the court. Thompson's business decision severed any causal connection between Mr. Kublal's actions and the claimed interference. Nothing counsel have told you today, and nothing in their papers, creates a material fact issue as to the Thompson business decision. Thompson specifically investigated each and every one of the complaints that Pride makes today and against Mr. Kublal, including an alleged undisclosed financial interest in TalentNet, including misrepresentations made to the company, including that he had some ulterior motive in promoting TalentNet, all of which was investigated both by his direct managers, his current and former managers, others within the Thomson Reuters chain of command. Robert Goodall captured and reviewed all of Mr. Kublal's Thomson Reuters emails, interviewed Pride and others at Thomson Reuters, reached out to Pontoon, who did not participate, and Pride itself sabotaged the investigation by claiming to have a recording of Mr. Kublal to support its claims, which it refused to provide to TalentNet, did not produce in this litigation, and has admitted that it failed to preserve such recording. The only inference to be drawn is that no alleged bribe occurred and that that Pride never had those recordings and spoliated that evidence. Nothing in the record suggests that Mr. Kapal did anything but act within the scope of his authority as directed by Thomson Reuters senior management. The Thomson Reuters business decision to proceed with direct sourcing using the TalentNet solution was approved at the highest levels, both before and after Pride's complaints.
What about his relationship with TalentNet? So he's going on a speaking tour that's sponsored by TalentNet. Doesn't seem to be part of his job at Thomson Reuters. He's coming up with a model in which Pride gets business for TalentNet that's unrelated to its work for Thomson Reuters, right?
Not sure I understand that Pride. You mentioned that that Mr. Kapal would. I'll go back to your original question. I think the framing of your question is incorrect because it wasn't a speaking tour. It was part of Mr. Kublal's job to appear at direct sourcing or contingent labor conferences on behalf of Thomson Reuters to talk about the future of the industry. It was Mr. Kublal's job to transform Thomson Reuters' contingent labor practices to reduce costs and reduce the number of vendors with whom Thomson Reuters worked. He succeeded in doing that through the TalentNet solution. I would also mention that counsel's framing of...
So we have this claim that when he says that Pride is not a global company and is resistant to change, that those are misrepresentations. So in what way were they actually not a global company, resistant to change, and the TalentNet model was better?
I think you're comparing two things that aren't comparable, right? So the framing of the Pride relationship with Thomson Reuters is misstated by counsel. It was an indirect business relationship through this MSP, the managed service provider Pontoon. When Pride says that its business relationship was terminated by Thomson, what really happened was that the Pontoon contract was allowed to expire. It was an at-will contract. And so what Pride is really saying here is that they had some sort of right to get a new indirect or direct contract relationship once Thomson Reuters' Pontoon contract ended, which is, I would say, a different theory than it is put before the court of tortious interference with business relations, but perhaps of prospective business relations, right? So I think the entire framing of Thomson Reuters ending its business relationship with Pride is incorrect. The model changed by replacing a managed service provider Pontoon with a different pairing of Randstad and TalentNet. And what TalentNet enabled Thomson Reuters to do was to bring in-house its contingent labor sourcing. And so instead of going to Pontoon and Pride to identify candidates for temporary workers at Thomson Reuters who would be payrolled by Pride, TalentNet enabled Thomson Reuters to build its own pool of temporary workers that it could hire directly. This was a tremendous success for TalentNet, as submitted in the Thomson Reuters declarations. It has saved the company millions of dollars. 80% of its contingent labor workforce is now hired directly through its direct sourcing model. And the record reflects that...
Contingent labor workforce is in the company and they just get moved around, or there's a pool of people outside the company who come in for temporary jobs?
The tool enables Thomson Reuters to identify candidates from outside the company with whom they've previously worked on other temporary assignments so that they can... So they don't have to start from scratch each and every time they wish to fill temporary roles at the company. The record reflects...
Why is that incompatible with Pride doing the payroll work for those employees?
Pride is alleging that it had some sort of right to be included in the new model, right?
You don't have a right to do that.
Right.
But there's nothing incompatible about the new model with the services Pride was providing, which was payroll, right?
Payroll services were correct. There was.
You could have the direct sourcing model with payroll services provided by Pride.
I think. Are you asking could Thomson Reuters have chosen to hire Pride to provide payroll services to its direct source candidates?
Yeah.
I suppose it could have, but it made a business decision not to. And Pride just seeks to second guess the business decision made by Thomson Reuters.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is there's this claim that saying Pride is not a global company or is resistant to change were misrepresentations.
Right.
And so I'm trying to get at whether they are misrepresentations.
Can I ask a question about terminology? When you're referring to global capacity, are we talking geographically or functionally?
I think in this context, the term global was about scalability, right? So when the existing contingent labor practices began with many, many different vendors providing access to contingent workforce around the world, right? And so the idea was to bring in a company that could scale to provide those services on both in the United States and Canada and everywhere that Thomson Reuters did business to reduce the number of vendors. Thomson Reuters determined that the TalentNet tool enabled that scalability, which has turned out to be true, right? As Wendy Stanger testified in her declaration, this program has been a success. I would add, as for the supposed misrepresentations about what Pride could and could not do, the RFP process was reviewed in detail by Mr. Kublal's managers and by the very person that Pride claims was unhappy with the shift away from Pontoon, Lisa Moyer. Lisa Moyer and Nicholas Pasequin, who was Mr. Kublal's manager at the time, reviewed this RFP process in detail and found nothing wrong. So the idea that the speculative guess that Mr. Kublal somehow misrepresented something to his employer, which is not in the record, is undone by the subsequent investigation and determination that he had done no wrong and that Thomson Reuters wished to proceed with the direct sourcing plan and directed Mr. Kublal to proceed. In fact, when the allegations were by Pride were made, Mr. Kublal wrote that he was suspending any decisions related to the program. That was overcome by his manager's specific direction to proceed. No, we are not suspending the implementation of this program. We are going to proceed, Mr. Kublal.
What about the allegation that he sought the job for $250,000? I guess you said a moment ago because the recording didn't materialize, you're saying that just never happened. You think that was just a lie?
There's no evidence of the bribe solicitation. It's immaterial because it's conduct not directed at Thomson Reuters, the party with whom Pride wishes to have a business relationship continue.
But it might establish a motive for misrepresenting something to Thomson Reuters to punish Pride.
Right? It's also implausible, right? You asked about when Mr. Kublal left Thomson Reuters. He was let go as part of a reduction in force over a year after the events at issue. At the time, his salary was in the $240,000 range, just under the amount that Pride claims he sought in his employment with Pride. So it is implausible that he would devise a scheme to get himself.
Well, if he thought it was going to be fired, it's not crazy for him to seek a job at the same salary. Like, it's not as if.
Well,
the motivation was not to get a bump up in salary, it was to get a job when he thought he was going to be terminated, right? That's the allegation.
Well, I would disagree that there's anything to suggest that he thought his job was in jeopardy in the record, right? That's pure speculation. And instead, the Thomson Reuters declarations, the email record both before, during, and after the Pride allegations show legitimate non-tortious reasons for Mr. Kublal's actions, all of which were within the scope of his employment, all of which were reviewed by Thomson Reuters and determined to be within the scope of employment and in Thomson Reuters' best interests. And I guess the last thing we have not touched on today would be the sole motivation theory of Pride's case, which of course cannot stand because Pride has alleged mixed motives, right? And the Thomson declarations provide legitimate reasons for Mr. Kublal's actions. I see I'm out of time unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Klausner, you have reserved 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe Appley's argument highlights that there are factual disputes in this case. When counsel says there is nothing in the record to support that Mr. Gublal made this threat, there are affidavits from two of the Pride witnesses who were at the meeting when Mr. Gublal made the actual threat, and they lay out in detail what transpired there. When he says that there's nothing in the record regarding his misrepresentations about Pride not being a global company or embracing change, that's not true. JA 191 is the email that Mr. Gublal writes to his supervisor in Europe where he says just that. Pride is not a global company, nor have they embraced the change. When he says that there is no evidence that Mr. Gublal was concerned about his job security, that's not true either. The CEO of Pride has testified that he told him he was.
Causation again. Is there anything that you can point to that suggests that Pride would have retained this contract if not for the alleged conduct by Gublal?
Yes, because the evidence is Mr. Gublal made the decision to terminate Pride, and that everyone at Thompson was very pleased with Pride's work for years until Mr. Gublal had this incident with Pride, who refused to be complicit in his scheme. And so, but for Mr. Gublal running this, what we call a sham RFP, as a pretext so that he had the opportunity to get rid of Pride, Pride would not have lost its work with Thomson Reuters. This was all part of the scheme he devised in order to get rid of Pride and get work to TalentNet, with whom we believe he had a personal relationship. So the final point that I...
What about the mixed motive point? So if, in fact, he did have some kind of interest in TalentNet or wanted to work with them, or maybe even was thinking about the future that he was going to work with them whenever he left Thomson Reuters, as long as that's consistent with Thomson Reuters' interest, if it's a mixed motive, then he's still acting within the scope of his employment, right? So it has to be that he has some kind of divergent interest from the company, right?
Right. Well, if his sole motive was to hurt Pride, that would be sufficient to prove the claim of tortious interference. If that was his motive in causing Thomson Reuters to end its relationship, if it was not his sole motive, but he caused the.
But if in fact he had the motivation to hurt Pride, but in doing so he also benefited Thomson, that wouldn't show that he had divergent interests, right?
But
maybe he was very excited that he had an opportunity to terminate Pride because he didn't like them, but it was a happy coincidence that also it served the interests of Thomson Reuters that he could do so. Right? You would not prevail if that were the case. You have to show that there's a divergence of interests.
Well, but there are alternative elements that you can use to establish a tortious interference. One is that he was solely motivated to hurt Pride. Another is that he caused Thomson Reuters to make his decision based on misrepresentations about Pride or through his own deceptive conduct, whether that was hiding his relationship with TalentNet or creating this RFP as a pretext to convince Thomson Reuters to terminate that relationship. So the mixed motives might go to whether he was solely motivated to hurt Pride, but it does not excuse this alternative theory that if he was misrepresenting things to Thomson Reuters to facilitate his termination of Pride, that itself would stand alone as a tortious interference. So my final point, Your Honors, is just based on this record and even based on argument today, we do believe that there are a number of factual disputes that should let this case go forward so that a fact finder can assess credibility and the conflicting evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. The next argument on the calendar is number 21707, United States versus Farouk. Thank you.
whenever you're ready.
Bussing. Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Joshua Bussin, and I represent the appellant in this case, Khawaja Mohammed Farouk. I did not represent Mr. Farouk in the district court. Your Honors, this court should vacate Mr. Farouk's conviction because the district court failed to ensure that Mr. Farouk knew about an essential element of the crime before he pleaded guilty to committing that crime. In United States versus Jackson, this court held that wrongfulness is an essential element of Section 875D. However, in the district court, Mr. Farouk was never informed of this essential element. It was not included
Jackson
in the...
Jackson also said that the threat's inherently wrongful when there's no claim of right to the thing that the individual's trying to get. And here, I thought Farouk stipulated to that he didn't have a claim of right to any relationship with Jane Doe.
I think that's too narrow of a reading of Jackson. Jackson said that one way to disprove wrongfulness is to show that you were entitled to the thing that you were seeking. But wrongfulness, as this court endorsed it in Jackson, reaches more than just entitlement. This court adopted the reading of extortion from Clemente, also from this court, which held that wrongfulness means using a wrongful method to achieve a wrongful objective. So all of those things would have to be proven to show that an act was wrong.
The district court asks a series of questions to make sure that Farouk understands the charges against him, right, and what he's pleading guilty to. And she says, you threatened to expose these photos because you wanted to make her feel threatened, right? Like he agrees to that series of events. I mean, isn't that wrongful? So if in fact his later story that they were in cahoots and it was all voluntary or coordinated, shouldn't he not have agreed that his intent was to make her feel threatened?
I think that starts to get into the difference between what is required under 11B1G and what's required under 11B3. The district court's questions were probing for a factual basis, but they did nothing to inform Mr. Farouk of what the government would have to prove at trial. Although Mr. Farouk answered the questions and believed under the reading of the law as it was presented to him that he was guilty, he had an incomplete understanding of the law. The indictment here did not include the element of wrongfulness, and that is the only instruction that the district court gave to him on the law. If you look at the back and forth that took place after that, and that comes in the appendix.
But your position is that from his perspective, he did not understand it because he thought he was guilty, but if he had known about the wrongfulness element, he would not have pleaded guilty because what he was doing was pretending to extort her and to threaten her because they were acting in coordination and she really wanted to marry him in the end result. You're saying he reasonably believed that he was still guilty of extortion because the formal acts he was doing looked like extortion to an outside observer.
I think
he didn't appreciate that because, in fact, it was all consensual with respect to the victim, that it therefore wasn't illegal.
I think as the law was explained to him, it was understandable for him to assume that having sent a message that on its face appears to be extortion, that he is guilty of the crime. That is the end of the story. The government, under his understanding, didn't have to prove that he had a wrongful intent to instill fear of harm to obtain a wrongful objective.
But is it his story that he, in fact, did not intend to instill fear of harm?
That's right.
So wasn't it explained to him that he was pleading guilty to a crime in which he instilled fear of harm?
No, I don't think so. The indictment simply recites the statutory elements of the crime, which say that he committed a threat to reputation. I don't think that it goes far enough under what this court held in Jackson, which is requiring a showing of wrongful intent to instill fear of harm to achieve a wrongful objective.
So you're saying that basically Mr. Farouk had a rightful intent to instill fear of harm, or that's his argument?
I think that he would have had the ability at trial.
But he was not, in fact, instilling fear of harm, right? Because his argument is that she would not have feared harm from him.
I think he would have been.
Or did she have a reason to fear harm? But that was also part of the plan.
I think at trial he would have been able to argue that he both had a non-wrongful objective, which was that he was trying to help Jane Doe by getting her away from her brother-in-law, and also that he was working with her and that there was no attempt to instill fear of harm in her. And either of those would have negated the government's burden of proving wrongfulness. And because he never knew about any of this, he had no chance to raise it in front of the district court during the plea. But in his motions to withdraw his plea...
Can I ask you this question? If, in fact, there was no element of wrongfulness, if we had never decided Jackson, could somebody be held guilty of extortion under the facts that he claims that was the truth, that he was in cahoots with the victim and never actually intended to do the harm?
Oh, I think so. I think without the wrongfulness element, there's all kinds of everyday extortion that could be technically swept up within the statute. In the United States versus Abeles case from this court, they used the example of a burglar alarm salesman who capitalizes on the fear of his customers to get their money to purchase his product. That is extortion, but it's not wrongful because you don't have a wrongful objective. And that example shows us why wrongfulness is important. It's important to separate innocent from criminal
conduct. But his version of events was that he actually was not capitalizing on her fear of anything because they were coordinating from the beginning, and so she had no reason to fear anything from him, right?
That's correct.
Isn't that his defense? So it's not even like the burglar alarm salesman.
It is a slightly different factual pattern from the burglar alarm salesman, but it still shows why wrongful intent is a necessary element of the crime that the government would have had to prove at trial. He never got the opportunity to even learn
that.
I'm saying
if, in fact, his version of events, the later version of events, that they're coordinating from the beginning is true, could you be convicted of extortion? Even putting aside the question of whether it's wrongful or not, it just would be the case that he was not extorting somebody, right? They were play acting in order to get the brother-in-law to release her.
If a jury accepted that, then yes, he would not be guilty of extortion under either reading of the statute. But the problem here was exacerbated because he never learned of the wrongfulness element. Now, just briefly, I see I'm running close to out of time,
but I was going to ask you to turn to the conditions of supervised release, and in particular, if you could start out by addressing what's not moot.
I have had a chance in the last 24 hours to look into mootness issues again, and I'll note that yesterday, in relation to the violation of supervised release, the district court revoked Mr. Farouk's prior supervision. He sentenced him to time serve and imposed a new supervised release term that will expire in February 2023. One condition that we challenged was reimposed, another was not. And our position is that both arguments are still justiciable. They are not moot under the doctrine of capable of repetition but evading review, and also for the attendant harm.
Because they could be reimposed. Well, let's start with the retraction requirement. How is that not?
The district court could still reimpose that on his supervised release if he violated again. So it is capable
of... possibility that the district
court did that. You could appeal that decision, right?
You could appeal that decision, but his supervised release is up in February, so it is highly unlikely that he would be able to get through briefing at this court and be able to get a decision before that. So it is escaping review. I think for both of the conditions, one is currently imposed and the other could be imposed if he violated. So they... both are capable of a repetition and evading review.
Can I ask you, so I know you have an argument that his appellate waiver was not knowing and voluntary, but if we were to say that it was, does the appellate waiver cover challenges to the conditions of supervised release?
No, the conditions of supervised release are not specifically mentioned, I believe, in the plea waiver. I believe it only discusses the sentence itself, and this court, as we cited in our brief, has not enforced plea waivers as to special conditions of supervised release when they're not specifically named in the plea agreement. And he had no notice that these specific conditions were going to be imposed, which in general lowers the burden even further for him to show that there was a plain error or that there was an abuse of discretion, excuse me. Here, I think as to both conditions, they're extremely overbroad in what would be permissible as a supervised condition, a condition of supervised release. They sweep up speech that is in no way unlawful or threatening. both on their face are subject-based restraints. And I think under the First Amendment, neither of those can survive review by this court.
But if somebody is harassing another person, oftentimes that's accomplished through speech about that person, right? So you're going to have subject matter-based restraints, are you not?
I think if you had a subject matter-based restraint that focused on unprotected speech, then you probably could impose...
What's unprotected speech? Just fighting words? You can't direct fighting words at the target of your harassment? Like, that's already...
I think it would have to come closer to fighting words or threatening speech at the very least. But saying that Mr. Farouk cannot...
extortion's not protected, and it seems like the district court's finding here was that the publication about Jane Doe, publications about Jane Doe were sort of related to the extortion in that they were designed to instill fear or to sort of remind Jane Doe of the potential for the publication of the nude photos.
I believe that the record reflects that they were related to conduct with John Doe, not Jane Doe. And so it takes even a further step away from the conduct that he pleaded guilty to. But additionally, for example, the order saying that he...
Does that change the threat? I mean, isn't the threat that it would be publication of her, about her, to John Doe and others in such a way that would, you know, ruin her life?
I understand that was the district court's concern and what it was trying to get to, but the condition that it issued says that he may not disseminate any information in any medium. So under that reading, he can't talk to his lawyer or his therapist without calling the district court for permission first. That sweeps up too much protection.
Well, the dissemination is public dissemination, doesn't it?
Dissemination, I think, could be read as speaking.
Okay, so if we were to say that we understand dissemination to be public dissemination, would that resolve the problem?
I still don't think so. I still think it sweeps up too much protected speech. There are too many ways that he could write articles or publicly disseminate things.
So there was this colloquy with the district court when she imposed the condition in which Farouk's attorney said, there's a First Amendment problem. What if he wants to write a book or something? And she said, well, if he wants to write a book, he can come get permission. But he's been directing too much speech at... John Doe and Jane Doe and using that as a threat to extort them, that I think the condition is necessary. So why doesn't the district court's expressed intent that if it really is something that's a matter of public concern, it would be allowed? Why doesn't that resolve the concern?
I think giving editorial control to the Eastern District of New York over publication of protected speech goes too far. I think that under this court's approach, which is in line with the Supreme Court's, that you can't sweep up protected speech or unprotected speech. You know, I was right. Protected speech just to get at unprotected speech.
Well, you can't do that as a general matter, but certainly as a condition of supervised release, you have less liberty than the general public, right?
That's correct. But the only cases.
So, in fact, hurling insults at a person. And even providing personal information about the person, you know, in a public venue would be protected speech. Like, there's no reason why that the First Amendment doesn't protect that. But for somebody who is a harasser, it seems like you could restrict that, right?
There
are going to be restrictions on protected speech. So your argument is not that there's protected speech that's restricted. Your argument is that it is far too broad and sweeps too much protected speech. So I guess my question is this: what is the speech in which he would want to engage that is unrelated to his harassment of the victim that he's now not allowed to do because of the condition?
He could write a book, an article, or a Facebook post saying, I feel like I was treated unfairly in this case. I don't think that would be harassing or threatening to the...
But if that doesn't communicate information about John Doe or Jane Doe, wouldn't that be allowed?
I think it depends on how you slice about Jane Doe or John Doe. This case is about them, and it gets very close in talking about his case to talk about them as well. I think if we broadened it to say if he wanted to write an article saying, I believe I was wrongly accused by Jane Doe in this case, that he should be able to do that because the First Amendment protects his right to do so.
Can I ask just before you sit down about the withdrawal of the guilty plea?
Sure.
So the district court seems to think that his story about being coordinating with Jane Doe is, she says, a lie, right? It just doesn't think it's true. Is that not a legitimate basis for declining to allow him to withdraw his guilty plea?
I think that unsubstantiated claims that a defendant is legally not guilty have been rejected in the past and upheld by this court. But where the defendant puts forward something more, this court has instructed the court should look into that. Here, Mr. Farouk said he had recordings that would show that he was legally innocent. The district court didn't appear to have listened to those or considered them in ruling on his motion to withdraw. And just one side note on that, although what the district court found as the honesty or truthfulness of his story does play into the motion to withdraw the plea, for the purposes of Rule 11, this court has found before that a defendant was likely guilty of the crime. In Irizarry, the court said the defendant was likely guilty, he probably knew that he was guilty, and it found that there was a factual basis for the plea, but it still said that the errors in the plea proceeding, failing to ensure that the defendant understood the crime, was an error that warranted vacating the conviction. And I think that the court should do the same here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Assistant United States Attorney Kayla Bensine for the government. I want to address each of counsel's arguments today, but I want to start by grounding them in the factual record in this case. The defendant for months threatened a young woman residing in Pakistan to disseminate nude photographs of her to other men, including her work colleagues, if she wouldn't return to a sexual relationship with him. The defendant admitted to this conduct at his guilty plea, and that grounded the district court's colloquy and subsequent denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. And that conduct also advised the court at sentencing in imposing tailored supervised release conditions that were reasonably related to the crimes in this case and the lengthy record of the defendant's violation of court orders. There was no plain error, and the district court did not abuse its discretion. So I'll just start with the Rule 11 errors, Your Honor. And I want to first turn to the argument about wrongfulness and the recitation of the law in Jackson and some of the other cases that the defendant cites to. And I want to be very clear that Jackson defined wrongfulness. Jackson, of course, required wrongfulness, but it defined wrongfulness as when a threat is used to obtain property to which the threatener is not entitled. That was part of the allocution in this case. The district court asked the defendant questions about this. The defendant, through his counsel, stipulated to this, and his counsel said, I spoke to my client about this prior to making that stipulation. So here, I think all of the elements that were actually described and defined in Jackson were part of the plea allocution in this case. So there have been
some acknowledgement that he did not have an entitlement to a relationship with Jane Doe sufficiently satisfies wrongfulness in your mind.
Yes, and just because it really tracks the language that this court used in Jackson, where it said a threat wrongful is when a threat is used to obtain property to which the threatener is not entitled. And here they stipulated that the property was the relationship with Jane Doe, and the defendant stipulated that he was not entitled to that. It very clearly tracks Jackson. That was both the government and defense counsel's intention, and I think it does track Jackson.
His argument now is that he is entitled to it, right? Because that they were coordinating all along, and so she wants to be with him, in which case, you know, it's, I mean, I guess he's not entitled to it, but he knows that she wants to give it, and so therefore, I guess my question is this. I mean, given his new version of the facts, could he have pleaded guilty even based on the district court's instruction at the time of the plea agreement?
Well, I guess what I'll say is, he made those claims months and months and months after the guilty plea in this case. In fact, he made a motion to withdraw a guilty plea without making those claims. And then even months after that, he finally made these claims about being in cahoots with Jane Doe. But I think the court referenced this in some of its questioning to my colleague, where he said that it was his intention that she feel that if she did not come back to him, he would send the pictures to other men, and that when he sent the transmissions, his goal was to get her to come back to him or agree to marry him. And so that is just contradictory to what he said later on in his second or third motion to withdraw his guilty plea. So he allocated to this. This court has held time and time again that a defendant's statements under oath should be credited unless seriously undermined by something down the line, and that wasn't the case. Just to get into the motion to withdraw the guilty plea for a minute, my colleague stood up here and said that, well, it has to be supported by some sort of evidence, and here it was supported by these recordings, but that's not the case. The recordings were presented to the district court at sentencing. In fact, the sentencing was adjourned month after month so that the defendant could get these recordings translated. The district court was very, very clear during the sentencing proceeding that she had reviewed all of the transcripts. And if you look at the transcripts themselves, which are part of the confidential appendix, you'll see that none of them support the claim that the defendant is now making. So there really is nothing underpinning this. The transcripts of these recordings are undated, so I think that they're entitled to very little weight. But all they do is indicate that at some point the defendant had a romantic relationship with Jane Doe, which everybody agrees on, and that the defendant and John Doe had disagreements about the nature of that relationship. So they don't actually underpin what the defendant pled guilty to and what he allocated to.
They don't show that they were in coordination when at the time he was extorting, but they do show that there was a consensual relationship at some time.
Right, which was the whole theory of the case, that there was a consensual relationship at some point. She cut that off, and the defendant never accepted it and didn't just not accept it, but threatened her in email after email, communication after communication for months, Your Honor, which is all set forth in the PSR in this case. I want to just briefly turn back to Jackson and address some of the arguments.
So you're saying that in terms of withdrawal of the guilty plea, that actually this is just like other cases with an unfounded claim of innocence?
Well, and the court made a factual determination here that the defendant was lying. The record is replete with the defendant lying, and I think the standard there is clearly erroneous, and I don't think that that can be even close to being met under the factual record that the court has before it. I want to just briefly address this argument from Jackson that there must also have been an intent to instill fear of harm. So, I Jackson was very, very clear about the requirement of wrongfulness and what that has to entail. And I think Jackson, too, when it went back to the Second Circuit, was even clearer. The court held that the court should have informed the jury of the wrongfulness element by instructing that 875D prohibits obtaining money or a thing of value from another by use of threats to reputation only if the defendant has no plausible claim of right to the money demanded or if there is no nexus between the threat and the defendant's claim. There's nothing in there about having to specifically prove fear. And I would note that some of the cases that are cited by the defendant, for example, I think a Fourth Circuit case, United States versus White, really come to the conclusion that once you've met that wrongfulness standard, it's implied that the threat is by fear or by force, you know, in the Hobbs Act, for example.
There's two parts to it, right? There's the entitlement to the thing that you're trying to get, and then there's the means that you use to do that. And the focus, I think, here is that the wrongfulness from Jackson addresses the former, but not the latter. And it's, I guess, theoretically possible that the latter could be completely kosher without, the wrongfulness requirement would be necessary to get to the mental state there.
Right. I think either way, you're getting to the wrongfulness intent that Jackson requires. And so I don't think that this additional requirement of specifically stating some sort of fear makes sense given the language of Jackson and what this court requires. And it certainly wouldn't be plain error in any event. So I can now just briefly address the supervised release conditions in this case. I do think that the second condition as to the redactions or the retractions of the prior articles is absolutely moot. This court held in Browder, a recent summary order, 807 Federal Appendix 44, that where a condition of supervised release is modified or the term expires, challenges to such conditions are rendered moot.
Well, what about the other conditions? So can he comment on his case? Can he say, I think I got a raw deal from the district court? and not run afoul of that condition?
Absolutely. And in fact, there were multiple articles that the defendant wrote during the pendency of this case, and some of them called the prosecution the mafia and, you know, made allegations against the district court judge. And
so what can't he say? Can he say, I think Jane Doe improperly accused me or wrongly accused me?
I don't think he can disseminate information about Jane Doe without getting...
If he has an opinion about her conduct in the case, he can't express that without the district court's approval.
I think that's right. For the period of supervised release, which was obviously a short period in this case, it's
now,
only...
Isn't that overbroad? I mean, that's not harassment. That's about what happened to him in this trial. That's not about some accusation that he's going to disseminate nude pictures of her.
Well, I think in that case, that would be the kind of thing that the district court would say, you're entitled to do this. This doesn't cross the line into being threatening. And that was the whole back and forth at the sentencing proceeding in this case where the district court said...
Isn't that a problem if the district court gets to decide whether he's allowed to criticize the conduct of the trial?
Well, no, because I don't think that's quite... I think the district court was wanting to be in a position where he could not disseminate information about Jane Doe or John Doe. So whether or not that would even qualify as information, I think, is a question. I'm not sure that it does qualify as disseminating information. It's his opinion. And so I think...
Well, the idea that they're being... She's being kidnapped and all of that is also, I guess people would say, it's his opinion because a lot of people don't believe it.
Right, but I think that falls squarely within what the district court was trying to prohibit. And so I think if you wanted to say that she was being kidnapped by John Doe and all of the rest, I think that would fall within the same harassing conduct that underpinned the factual conduct of the case originally. And so I think that would be prohibited by...
If he just wants to repeat his defense, if he just wants to say, I was wrongly convicted because, in fact, I was in coordination with Jane Doe... He needs to get the district court's approval to say that.
To disseminate that, Your Honor. I mean,
first of all, disseminate, I guess, just to clarify this, your view of that is it's public dissemination. It's not any statement that he makes to anybody.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
Okay, so he can't publicly disseminate that. He can't say that to the public unless he gets the district court's permission.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly.
So that means he can't even repeat the defense he made in the trial proceedings to the public without getting the district court's permission?
Right, for just the limited period of supervised release, and he has to get approval by the district court. I think that is not overly broad in a case like this where the defendant repeatedly violated court orders and repeatedly...
Well, I think you were saying it is overly broad because you're saying that that's a case where the district court should let him do it, that the overbreath is a tool to make sure he doesn't end up disseminating harmful information.
Well, I think the claim that, you know, he had gotten into a marriage with Jane Doe and that she had been kidnapped, that is harmful information. That is some of the factual conduct that underpinned this case, the threats case, Your Honor. I think as to him just saying, I was wrongfully convicted, I'm not sure that counts as dissemination of information. If I were his attorney, I would probably advise him to write to the court in any event. But I'm not sure that qualifies as an actual dissemination of information. And so I do think that it is narrowly tailored and reasonably related to the conduct in this case.
Well, so now it expires in February, but before this morning's modification or whenever it was that it happened, it was indefinite, right? So what accounts for the change? Weren't the conditions indefinite?
No, I think that was a misunderstanding from the defendant's brief.
Oh, okay. So what was...
So the supervised release condition just lasts for the period of supervised release, which is 1 year. That got that should have expired in the spring. It got extended because the defendant violated one of the other conditions of supervised release.
Now it is extended until February?
Until February of next year. Only a few more months, Your Honor.
Can I just, what are we talking about in terms of dissemination of public information? I thought there was something about the defendant being a journalist or having credentials that made this sort of particularly relevant as opposed to just like a social media post or something.
Right, that's exactly right. So as the court alludes to, the district court even applied, I think, a sort of unusual Chapter 3 of the sentencing guidelines enhancement in this case based on the defendant's use of a special skill, which is his repeated use throughout the pendency of the conduct in this case where he would say things